From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Tony Award nominations are out, and there's some big names and one big omission on the list. Then the creators of The Good Fight, Robert and Michelle King, their show tackles issues of election hacking, racial inequality, and sexism. But most of all, they try to confront how the legal system can sometimes distort the facts in order to tell a good story.
We looked at courtroom shows of the past, and it always felt like the person who gave the most ethical argument won the case, and it never seemed to fit up with reality.
All that coming up on The Frame. The Tony nominations were announced today, and the big surprise was that Aaron Sorkin's acclaimed stage adaptation of Harper Lee's classic novel To Kill a Mockingbird was not nominated for Best Play. It's a bit like when Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Mr. Rogers documentary, was considered the front runner for the Best Documentary Oscar, but it didn't even get a nomination. We reached Jesse Green via Skype today. He's the co-chief theater critic for the New York Times, and I wanted his take on the Tony nominations. I started by asking him about the apparent snub of To Kill a Mockingbird.
I think the real issue is the category is Best Play, which in Tony terms means Best New Play. And To Kill a Mockingbird, however radically adapted it may have been by Aaron Sorkin, and however successfully so, it's fundamentally not a new work. So I think the nominators weren't going to choose a beloved novel's adaptation in the category of Best New Play.
Let's talk about the nominations for Best Play. They are Choir Boy, which started at the Geffen Playhouse out here in Westwood, Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus, Ink, What the Constitution Means to Me, and this play, The Ferryman, which tied with To Kill a Mockingbird for the most nominations for a play with 9. I spoke with the author of The Ferryman, Jez Butterworth, about his play. It's about the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and this is what he had to say about writing the story, which is set entirely in one family's kitchen.
I just like the idea and the challenge and the tightrope walk of staying in one place and allowing it to steep and to boil and just create this kind of pressure cooker environment. If you can get that pressure cooker situation going, you can get people to imagine absolutely anything.
So what was your take on the nominees for Best Play?
Well, as expected, The Ferryman is one of the leading contenders, and I think it's really, in an odd way, going to come down to that versus a real dark horse, What the Constitution Means to Me, an off-Broadway play if ever there was one.
The last time I was in New York, it hadn't yet moved to Broadway. I didn't get a chance to see What the Constitution Means to Me. For people who haven't seen it, how would you describe it?
Well, it's a one-woman memoir of a show, or that's what it starts out seeming to be. This woman, Heidi Schreck, tells the story of how she made money for college by performing, talking about various amendments and giving impromptu speeches about various things related to the Constitution. But then it becomes about her own interaction with the protections that do or do not shelter women in our country and the ways in which the Constitution as a document has so far failed them.
The most nominations overall with 14 and Best for a Musical was a new show called Hadestown. It's a musical that's been, I think, more than a decade in the making. It just opened. I'm going to listen to a little from the show. The song is called Wait For Me, performed by Andre DeShields and Reeve Carney.
Keep on walking and don't look back till you get to the bottom line.
Wait for me.
Sounds like it's got some Greek underworld in it. What is this show about?
Well, it is based on the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, very good, as well as sort of combined with the story of Hades and Persephone. It's about an artist, a singer, who goes to the underworld to try to fetch his wife back. But it's told in a very grand mythic style, very beautiful pop folk music, and incredibly well-directed and staged. Some people are not, including myself, some people are not totally buying what it's selling, but I love the way it's selling it, and that's why I got just about every single nomination it could save one.
As is often the case, there were several actors who are probably better known for their work in movies and TV who are nominated for their acting performances. Jeff Daniels in To Kill a Mockingbird, Adam Driver in Burn This, Annette Bening in All My Sons, and Bryan Cranston in the stage adaptation of the movie Network. We talked with Cranston about playing the lead role of Howard Beale, the news anchorman past his prime. Here's what Cranston had to say about that role.
He's an island unto himself. And you'd think that that person is reaching out to find connectivity with other human beings. But to serve the play, I realized that he had to invest in his aloneness.
The acting picks, to me, didn't feel too Hollywood heavy. What did you think about the selections for actors?
Well, the big snub, if you want to use that word, would have been not nominating Glenda Jackson as King Lear. Glenda Jackson, of course, came back to the theater in England for the first time after decades of being in Parliament. A lot of people are reeling over that one. But otherwise, you're right. It's an interesting mix of theater stalwarts, a few movie celebrities, and some relative unknowns, including the author and star of that play I mentioned earlier, What the Constitution Means to Me, Heidi Schreck, who, you know, frankly, no one had ever heard of except critics until about 8 months ago.
Out here, for better or for worse, we can look at the Oscars as a kind of barometer of where Hollywood is headed, what movies matter to the industry, and so on. And if the Tonys can be seen as offering a glimpse into where Broadway is and how it sees itself, what would the takeaway be from this morning's nominations?
Well, the good takeaway would be that Broadway seems to be accepting new kinds of material from more unusual backgrounds and with a more direct and challenging approach to the audience. I'm talking about plays like What the Constitution Means to Me or Gary, the sequel to Titus Andronicus. In a negative sense, to answer your question, this is a slate of nominees, particularly in the writing and directing categories, that is very slim on anyone who is not a white male. And that's a problem, a structural problem going forward.
Jesse Green is the co-chief theater critic for the New York Times. Jesse, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
Follow that dollar for a long way down. Far away from the poorhouse door. You either get to hell or to Hades town. Ain't no difference anymore. Way down Hades town.
Coming up, the creators of The Good Fight on how Donald Trump changed their show.
Hound dog howling, a whistle blow. Train come a rolling, clickety clank. Nobody knows where that old train goes. Those who go, they don't come back. They're going way down Hades town, way down under the ground.
This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Remember how in most legal TV dramas, the attorney with the most ethical and factual argument would usually prevail? Well, according to the creators of the courtroom comedy drama The Good Fight, that's not always what happens in real life, and the idea that truth wins also doesn't make for good storytelling. The Good Fight is a spin-off of The Good Wife. Both shows were created by the husband and wife team of Robert and Michelle King. The Good Fight follows the Christine Baranski character, Diane Lockhart, who joins a law firm navigating a post-factual world. Delroy Lindo and Audra McDonald also star. While characters in the show openly air their feelings about the Trump presidency, the Kings actually expected Hillary Clinton to be in the White House when they conceived the show's pilot.
Well, we were filming the first episode of the first season when Donald Trump was elected. So we were filming that night, and that changed our thinking.
And probably the world changed in a better way for the show, maybe not for the world itself, but for the show. In Trump winning, we decided to shoot a new opening to the show, which would be Christine Baranski sitting on her couch, kind of in a darkened room, watching Trump's inauguration. So that felt like it gave a little bit of drive through Christine's character's sense of feeling adrift in this new world.
That's an interesting point, because we have talked over the last couple of years about comedians and satirists who say their job is actually more difficult with Trump, that in some ways it's more challenging to find humor or satire because to their minds, things seem so satirical anyway. But as narrative dramatic storytellers, you see it slightly differently. So what does that mean for you as storytellers in terms of what you're using? Because you don't even use an alias for the Trump family. They are by name in the show. So what does that mean for you as you're writing episodes?
Perhaps it's easier for us because the characters are having extreme reactions. So that can be dramatized. as opposed to, I imagine, if you are trying to cover the news and it feels like the New York Times is suddenly the Onion.
Nurse Dodo said it was an accidental shooting by another member of the hunting party, and it was 48 hours before he was brought in.
So, what was the delay?
She didn't say. But then I checked Eric Trump's Instagram.
And?
He posted a picture of himself standing over a dead giraffe within that 48-hour period.
You're telling me Kurt was shot by one of the Trumps, but they didn't take him to a doctor because they wanted to shoot a giraffe?
I don't want to draw a conclusion, but yeah.
What we wanted to do was use the present day and skew it like 10 to 20% to fit Diane's new attitude towards the world.
Do you ever say to yourselves when you're either writing or editing or looking at a final cut of an episode, oh my goodness, this is so depressing. Even as we're trying to have fun, we need to not really dwell so much on what's really going on in the world?
No, I'll only speak for myself. I think we're having too much fun with it to feel like it's depressing.
Yeah, we've always had a lot of fun looking at certain things that are going on in reality and twisting it and having fun with it.
I want to play a clip from the third season. It's a character played by Michael Sheen. He's named Roland Blum, and he sees himself kind of as the embodiment of corruption and calls himself Roy Cohn incarnate.
Let's talk strategy. As attorneys, we are not finders of fact. We are tellers of story. You gonna write this down or what?
We take the evidence and we craft it into a coherent narrative for the jury. I get it.
You don't get it. Who said anything about evidence?
We base the story on the evidence, no?
No, we base the evidence on the story. We prove what helps us, we disprove what hurts us. Whoever tells the best story goes home with cash and prizes.
It's a great line. But it's also about this broader idea about being in a post-factual world where the facts don't matter as much as the way that you convey what it is you are trying to argue. And I'm wondering how that fits into where you see yourselves and the whole sense of the legal system and what it does right and what it does wrong and the fact that facts aren't as important as they might have been not that long ago.
We looked at courtroom shows of the past, and it always felt like the person who gave the most ethical argument won the case, like the jury voted for them. And it never seemed to fit up with reality. Reality always felt like it was the person who gave the best sense of a narrative that was convincing. And now I think you're seeing that in, obviously, the world in politics. I mean, it probably always was that way. As we were trying to show Roy Cohn, there's a direct descent from Roy Cohn to Donald Trump. And that was always his attitude, which is there is no arc of history. It is what you make of this moment, what fact that you tangle to support whatever argument you want to make. And everything else is kind of BS.
And the key for the character is just be entertaining.
Right.
That's it's not about being truthful or being right. It's be a lot of fun to watch.
We're talking with Michelle and Robert King, the creators of The Good Fight. Christine Baranski plays Diane Lockhart. And I would say up until this third and current season, her character feels like she's always been able to handle everything that's thrown at her, but now it feels like she's kind of hanging on by her fingernails a little bit. And I'm wondering if that is intentional on your part, that like a lot of people, she doesn't really know where there's even ground to stand on.
Definitely.
Very much so.
Yeah,
I mean, Christine embodies it so brilliantly.
Yeah, I know. These are actors who feel that in their lives. And then they come onto the set and they feel very much like they're continuing it. I think with Christine, we have one character say that the guardrails are gone and they can't even see the road anymore. And I think that's, you know, Diane Lockhart's character is she's struggling with, in the absence of institutions that are respected, what do you do?
I want to ask you about how you cast your writer's room. It's often the case that in a single episode, you have issues of racism, misogyny, internet culture, maternity, political extremism. How do you make sure that you have created a writer's room where you can address those issues and even challenge some of the traditional ways of thinking about those issues, even if it makes some people uncomfortable?
Right. Well, I can tell you we've got 7 writers other than ourselves. 4 of them are women. 3 of them are over 50. I believe one's over 65. Two of them are African American. Two of them are gay. Two of them are attorneys, which is actually the only thing we can actively sift for. Five of them are also playwrights, and all of them are spectacular writers.
I think the only thing we do, you know, we don't go out to set up that kind of cross-section. What you're really looking for is based on scripts, who's writing well, and who's, like, even if it doesn't have to be a TV script, it could be a play that you react to. But what you're looking for are good writers, and then you throw all these people into a room, and then you have them argue. And it was kind of amazing. We have an episode that's about the, you know, hacking an election, hacking voting machines. And it was surprising that there was difference of opinions. One of the African-American writers was just like, there is such an isolation of African-American voters. If he had a chance to change the percentage on the voting machines to accommodate for that, he would. And it just made this interesting argument that a lot of us hadn't really considered. And so Audra McDonald kind of basically gives a version of that speech within the show. So it's been fantastic to have this kind of cross-section.
I want to play a clip of an episode that you did that is really close to truth and not fiction.
Like the guy who was shot in his car with his girlfriend.
Philando Castile.
Right. There was video, so it was remembered longer than the guy who was killed in his apartment by an off-duty cop.
Botham Joan.
Right.
Same thing with the guy whose car broke down, that he knocked on somebody's door.
Jonathan Farrell.
Do you all notice that the black people here know the names of the victims of police shootings, but the others don't?
Obviously, that's 100% true. But what are the conversations that you're having with your creative team, your writers and your actors, about the way that a show like this can talk about race in subtle kind of casual conversation?
Part of it is not moving away from the difficult conversations, because the episode you just played a clip from also has, I think, a very difficult conversation about why the white associates in the firm are being paid more than the African-American associates, which and Delroy's character, Bozeman, who heads up the firm.
Who is African-American, we should say.
Who's African-American and runs the firm with Liz, played by Audra McDonald, have this very difficult conversation where they know they're not being progressive. They are being capitalistic. And that if you want to keep a firm around, what do you do? And part of this came about through arguments in the writer's room of, first of all, that reaction to the shootings came about through the writer's room, that for many years now, it's been noticeable in our writer's room that, you know, the whites in the room don't remember the names of those shot and the African-Americans do. And so it was a comment on that. But even more importantly was this idea of disparity that comes about through the needs of capitalism, which also the episode touches upon. And again, I hope that doesn't sound dry, because it's about people realizing they are part of the problem within the system.
Coming up, more about The Good Fight and the Kings weigh in on their former boss, disgraced CBS leader Les Moonves.
Full moon. Empty arms. The moon is there for us to share, but where are you?
Now let's get back to my conversation with Michelle and Robert King. They're the creators of the show The Good Fight. It's a spinoff of The Good Wife, and it can be seen on the streaming platform CBS All Access. CBS has been in the news a lot recently. Last year, 12 women accused disgraced CEO Les Moonves of sexual harassment and assault. He was subsequently fired. I asked Michelle and Robert King about the former network chief, but first I mentioned the open letter recently written in Variety by the former CBS executive Whitney Davis. She criticized CBS for what she called its white problem and toxic work environment.
We read that article, and I understood how things ended up where it did. We haven't had the same situation. We'd always pitched Good Fight, not Good Wife, as an African-American law firm, with Diane Lockhart being one of the few Caucasian associate or actually partners being brought in. And so it always felt like everything else that followed was essential to that. And it's a difficult situation. I would never contradict what she said at all. We've just had a different experience. But Michelle?
I was going to say we perhaps lived in a fortunate bubble in terms of casting. We have 9 series regulars. 5 of them are women and 5 of them are African American.
The current season opens with a video crew that's doing kind of a tribute video, and they're talking to a secretary, and she describes what has happened to her in her office.
We were doing an interview with his secretary.
We think you should see it.
He said he was tired. He had to give a speech that night, and I could help. He asked me to come behind his desk. He had his pants unzipped.
And what she says could be verbatim from what a secretary says at any Hollywood studio or network.
Right. I mean, this was about how a business reacts when an important figurehead within the business is discovered that he is raping secretaries. And this law firm depends on his good name. So what do you do? And that was the question the law firm faces.
I mean, because goodnesses are colliding in this episode because he is a true civil rights icon. Do you want to destroy that when there are folks that are looking to destroy civil rights icons for all the wrong reasons?
It's an episode about NDAs, about non-disclosure agreements, and them trying to get some of these women to sign. And, you know, how much are you corrupt when you do that? Because shouldn't we all be honest about, especially post-Me Too, you know, shouldn't everybody be honest about the skeletons in people's closets?
We're talking with Michelle and Robert King, the creators of The Good Fight. What was your reaction when you read the story about Les Moonves in The New Yorker? Because you knew him and have worked with him.
It was very hard. Very hard, because at first it was disbelief, and then it was this sense of being let down in a way. But I'd been watching Sarah Silverman and her reaction to Louis C.K., and I think you kind of go through some of the same things. You want to be defending someone who you like and a friend, but then some points you just turn that off because you just have to react to other people's stories who know much better and know more than you ever do. And that felt like Sarah Silverman had such, I thought, kind of very real reactions and very sad reactions to what was going on there. And I think we sometimes feel the same way, although Michelle, more to say on that.
No, not at all.
You don't have more to say.
That's right.
Okay.
I think Robert captured it.
I want to talk about the platform for your show, CBS All Access. It's the network streaming service. And I want to ask you about the advantages that that has, and what are the advantages to being there as opposed to being on the network?
Well, the biggest advantage for us is the length of the episode, that there's flexibility there. Because if you're on the network, you are stuck doing 42 minutes. With All Access, you can go as long as the episode needs to be.
And some of it is, you know, there's obviously more flexibility on language, mm-hmm. which doesn't sound like a real benefit except for writers. You know, you want to emphasize something. Sometimes the best thing is a swear word. And having one come out of Christine Baranski's mouth is always a joy. And then, we did try something this year where a lot of the characters have soliloquies, where they just start having interior monologues out loud. And I think we'd get a sideways eye if we tried that on network. It'd be, what the heck are you thinking? But here it just felt like part of the general sense of, okay, we know what audience we're writing towards. We know they'll go along for the ride. And then you have these theater actors and actresses that are great, and why not use them that way?
I want to ask you about material and about your upcoming CBS show called Evil, which I think is about a scientist against a priest. It involves the occult, and it feels like it could be very much based on things that are going on in the world. When you wake up in the morning, what is your media diet? Because it does feel like you are reading newspapers, watching TV. You're very much on top of what is going on in the world. And then how do you make the calculation as to what will and will not work in a given series?
I think if we're arguing about something, it feels potent for a series.
It's very difficult for us, for example, to do stories about immigration. Sometimes we do, because there's no gray area for Michelle and myself on that subject. And the same thing with capital punishment. And so the episode can only be earnest, or the series can only be earnest if you do that. And I think we have this, you know, joke teller sense of trying to avoid what is earnest. So it's better if you don't start with something that's so idealistic that you're then fighting against that.
Michelle and Robert King are the creators of The Good Fight. Michelle and Robert, thanks so much for coming on The Frame.
Thank you so much.
The Good Fight is on CBS All Access, and it has just been renewed for a fourth season. And that's The Frame for today. You can get our podcast wherever you like to listen. I'm John Horn. We'll be back here tomorrow.